Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I am your host, Nick Shutt. Very fortunate to have my friend Bill Pratt here today. Bill, how are you?
Doing all right, Nick. How are you doing today? I hope you had a great Thanksgiving.
It's another day in paradise. Thanks for asking. My Thanksgiving was amazing. I hope yours was as well.
Was.
Awesome. I'm glad to hear it. Bill, for everybody that doesn't know you, the unfortunate few, you mind telling us all a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you got here and what you're doing now?
Sure, great. So I'll go backwards a little bit. So right now I'm the Executive Director of Customer Relations at the Rely Group Inc. Rely Group is it's actually a mid-sized business now, the mid-tier business, and we just graduated and had a little bit of grandfathering left on some of our set-asides. But they grew up in the CMS space, CMS and HHS up in the Baltimore area, and they wanted to move down to DHS and do a little work. And so I, having been at DHS for 22 years, was kind of like a perfect marriage. Right at the end of the fiscal year last year, I determined to retire, which I did in January, and I started working for Rely right away. In fact, the very next day. And so, because we'd had some conversations leading up to that, and I gave plenty of notice for my pals at DHS. But I have a huge love for that mission. I was there 22 years. Ended up in the CTO's office, and I was the Director of Enterprise Technology Governance, essentially for IT. On behalf of the CTO and the CIO, we have a delegation to the CTO at DHS for this work. But all the acquisition lifecycle framework, from thought to retirement of an IT system, has a certain process you follow to make sure it's done right. Cost, schedule, performance, technical maturity, security, obviously, Section 508, things like that, to make sure all the laws are met. Enterprise architecture, going back to Clinger Cohen. And that's the acquisition piece. And then the systems engineering lifecycle, or that's what we call it at DHS, or the SDLC elsewhere. How are you building things? How are you getting them out to the world? And so we basically took the laws, we converted the laws to internal governance, we promoted the laws within DHS so that everybody knew what they had to do. We then measured against it. And if you saw the federal IT dashboard for OMB, when you see DHS, that was my former team. They still rock it. And they still do that. That's under the CTO as well. Although with Business Management Directorate provides the numbers, so we can check the investments. And then finally, if someone is off plan a little bit and not measuring up, then we triaged those deficiencies and got the programs with the subject matter expert who could help them. And then anytime any new law or policy came in, we would ingest that, incubate it, we called it, and then start the cycle all over again. The major programs were measured quarterly at DHS to make sure that that they were all on track and kept meeting the mission for the federal taxpayers. And so that was the last role I had, which I loved. We were able to push out Agile and DevOps across DHS and during my tenure, of course, with a bunch of wonderful peers. And also, we started to tackle the last 2 years I was there. We set up an emerging tech branch, the first at DHS, where we tackled the AI policy. And we did a little RPA and a little bit of low code, no code as well. But mostly artificial intelligence was pretty much dominating the landscape over the last couple of years. The CIO there, Eric Heisen, was the chief AI officer of DHS. He would hand off a lot of that to the CTO, Dave Larimore, who then handed off to our emerging tech branch. And my good friend Chakras Rongtrip ran that on my behalf then, and they did some amazing things, and they're still doing a lot of amazing things as I check in now to them. To get started though, I was a sailor. I spent 4.5 years on the USS Nimitz sailing around late 70s, early 80s. That's when I worked on my first computer systems. It was a rudimentary email system at the time, where with 25 terminals across the ship where they actually would get the message traffic right there, which was a groundbreaking at the time. Three refrigerators about the size of refrigerators, three UNIVACs rather, that looked like refrigerators. And of course, then we brought PCs in over the years. So after the Navy, I did 13 more years as a civilian working for the Navy, doing those telecom systems and increasing IT and bringing satellites in. Actually, we were using high frequency when I first got there, if you can believe it, in 1978. And then Did a couple of years at AT&T, a year there, half a year at MCI during the telecom boom, and then went to Freddie Mac for 4 years, where I did their Y2K transition work and tested all their systems along with some partners. And then at the end of that tenure, 9/11 hit. And right after that, I had moved. Freddie Mac had to, lost quite a bit of money on the trading floor, as many companies did at the time. That was a terrible economy right after 9/11. And then I went to work at INS, SAIC for INS at the time, to start working on the Student Exchange Visitor Information System, which was one of the key programs for folks coming to the, and it still exists for folks coming here to learn. And we wanted to make sure that system talked with all the other systems, all the watch list systems, all the other enforcement systems, a little bit better, and successfully did that for the first year. Then a couple of years later, DHS was stood up. It was actually INS at the time. So I stayed with ICE. Many of my peers went on to USCIS and OBIM, a biometric component, where those things still exist. And then in 13, I flipped and became a Fed in 08. And in 2013, I went to headquarters to do the streamlining of the SDLC and to start pushing Agile across the enterprise. We had already had some really great components, including ICE, where I was doing some good work, USCIS leading us a lot of the way too. And then got that done by the end of 2017. We were all the major component, all the major programs at DHS were being developed in an agile manner. And then we started tackling DevOps, and that's still underway. AI is still underway. And that brings us up to today. So I retired in January, got 22 years in, and hit that magic retirement age. And but I couldn't sit still. It's too much to do. So I'm back out here in industry, meeting with a lot of my friends and colleagues, and trying to support the mission.
It's amazing, man. I thank you for your service,
Thank
both in
you.
the Navy and to our country over the, over the last 40 years. It's amazing the work you've done. I also a huge proponent of the mission of DHS. We it's you know, people, I think a lot of people target political politically target different aspects of the organization's mission, when at the end of the day, somebody has to secure our homeland, whether it's whether it's our critical infrastructure under CISA, other our customs enforcement, under ICE, immigration customs enforcement. And a lot of people don't realize that DHS is the one in charge of securing our ports, I believe, as well, and tracking all of this, all the goods that come into and out of the country, and so much more. And it's a great organization full of a lot of really caring and committed individuals.
Absolutely. Yeah, it troubled sometimes because you get it from both sides. Some folks would think that CBP and ICE go too far. Other folks would make statements often from the political side saying, well, it's an open border and they're just walking across without any intervention whatsoever. And that really troubles me, because that puts a lot of ICE and CBP agents who are down there working super hard every day. It's as if they're not doing anything. So to be one of those folks and have to listen to that, I think you got to let it roll off to your shoulder to some extent, but I know you probably can't. And it's just about, I know that our leadership goes to Congress and shares, the actual results of what we're doing. We report out all the time, or they do. I'll say we a lot, and because it's hard to let go after 22 years. But I'm very, very proud to have worked there, and I'm very proud of the work they continue to do across all of the missions of DHS, which are, really varied, of course.
Absolutely. So speaking of AI and DHS, what's the state of the AI rollout within DHS, and are they tackling all this? Are they, kind of where are they going? How are they approaching?
Well, as of 11 months ago, and 11, I do check in now and then. But the first thing was, there's a couple of executive orders that came out that had very clear requirements and very clear deadlines, right? And also the National Defense Authorization Act came out that also added a number of other AI things. So the first thing we had to do is tackle those policy requirements. And and basically get things set up, get a bunch of our own internal policies written and approved. And for instance, the face recognition policy, that took about a year to get approved. And that was between, folks who did the enforcement on one side and wanted to be as strong and powerful as it could be, and the folks, civil rights and civil liberties and privacy folks on the other side, who very rightly wanted those protections in there. Well, back and forth for like a year, and just a huge number of people working on it. And the thing was to get the policy right, right? We wanted to leverage those tools, but we had to make sure that it didn't encroach on anybody's rights, civil rights, of course. And so that's one of the early things we did. And of course, science and technology, executive and the CIO jointly chair that AI working group there at DHS. That's still underway, although those folks will change now. At least the CIO will change given the end of the administration. But the work is going to continue to go on, and it always does. Some of the other things we did were to establish the initial AI inventory across the DHS. Whereas a number of AI tools we've already been using, we've been working with machine learning, natural language processing, probably for 3, 4, 5 years. And so the thing, and that goes across all the components. So, the requirement was to gather up everything we did, and the folks on our emerging tech branch did that work, and then they went back and did another deep dive, and that I think I'm pretty sure that work continues on. One of the other really interesting things, they hired these 50 new folks to come aboard for this AI core, which was great. Now, they hadn't hired any by the time I left, but I've since met quite a few of them, and that's really interesting as well. So the thing is, like in anything that happens in the federal government, at least from the governance compliance space, which is where I'd spent the majority of my time, is that there's a law, right? We're national laws, and laws come out, executive orders come out. Sometimes those are interpreted by OMB, and we get further guidance from OMB. Sometimes which is for the major ones, Clinger-Cohen, Federal IT Information Reform Act, that sort of stuff. You really do coordinate that at OMB, and then you coordinate it within the, we met at the at OMB with all the CIOs. The Evidence-Based Policymaking Act, when that came out to establish the chief data officer, we were in the room. I was kind of the stuckey from DHS that went over to OMB and then brought that back, and then we wrote the first policy there. So it starts with a law. I have kind of like five levels of policy that we follow. That's sort of things we put together over the year, but I still do this to this day, and I make sure that I kind of can overlay this on over any agency to see if they have all of it covered. But basically, you've got a law, then you've got to create a policy internal which says kind of what the rules are, what the roles and responsibilities are. The next level down is you write governance, right? You actually like your SDLC itself, right? You have to implement the policy, right? People can't just wing it from a policy document. So you kind of come up with some best practices and an end-to-end process. And I'm really proud of our SCLC. A lot of us have been working on that, probably for 10 years, and continually streamlining it to make it as lightweight as possible, to include adding Agile and DevOps to it. But then finally, so that's your policy there. That's your governance you walk around, but you don't walk around with that all day long with that tucked under your arm, right? So then the next level down is tools. And you write some templates, you write some tools, some websites, some decks that people can use day to day just to get the thing done well. And I think that's somewhere where AI can really make an improvement in the future. And then finally, the fifth level is the evidence layer. Okay. When GAO and OIG come knocking, where did she this is, think this section or paragraph of Clinger-Cohen or FATAR or whatever are the other laws, show me where you're doing this. You're required to do this. Show me where you're doing this. And so you need to have the evidence, whether that's a signature from a senior leader, whether that's meeting minutes. You have to be able to show the oversight folks that you've actually done it. So that's the five levels of the policy at DHS, that we've established. And then the other piece is this continual life cycle. We used to call it the circle of life there at DHS, but we're stealing liberally from the Lion King. But basically, you incubate whatever that policy is, then you broadcast the policy. You need to get it out there. It doesn't do anybody any good if it's on the shelf. broadcast it, make sure that, and sometimes the bigger changes, you take a roadshow to every component, every major program, and make sure they understand and give them a time chance for Q&A. And then once everybody has it, then you measure against it to make sure that it's being implemented and that we're actually doing it across the enterprise. And then finally, as I noted earlier, there's some, if there's some remediation needed, maybe need to adjust something. Maybe we didn't make something clear enough. So there's always an opportunity for continual improvement, which we've built into the process, a lot of feedback. And then we do it all over again and we keep that going continually. If new policy comes in, that gets ingested into the process and we keep the cycle going. So that's been very effective. I think there's really a lot of room for AI to help with that in the future. We were taking some baby steps towards that over the last several years. But money comes pretty money comes pretty stingy from Congress, for policy, for governance compliance, really. That's, we are oversight, right? The mission gets the money, and that's appropriate. So sometimes, especially for the last couple of years, a lot of the money's gone to the border appropriately, and we just had to do the best we could with what we had, and a lot of CRs going on as well right now. But we got it done. It was.
I was going to say, I think that that's like one of the benefits of Congress not passing a budget, but we're not here to give them a performance review. And it's fascinating as somebody who's never been internal in the government, looking at some of these system like these system shaking and fa like foundational shaking technologies that can fundamentally change the way that we're, interacting with and performing a lot of our jobs, right? And so I really appreciate the kind of the high level of from a law through policy, through and obviously the high level tools and the deployment and rolling it out and then continuing feedback and continuing to check on it. Because I think a lot of people don't understand like what, and I certainly don't understand what goes into that on a day-to-day basis, by any stretch of the imagination. And so having done this for the last, at this point, like last 10 years, with the Agile and DevOps, what were some of the Agile and DevOps rollout, agency-wide, what are some of the major difficulties that you had with rolling out, a new methodology like this, agency-wide? And then what do you think some of the lessons that folks, whether DHS or elsewhere, can pull from some of the stuff that you've done to try to make some of these rollouts more efficient and make them better for not just the employee, federal, but not just like the appointees and the high level, but the GS, call it, sevens through 14s that are doing a lot of the hands-on day-to-day work.
Yeah, we definitely had a lot of lessons learned there. So it was interesting that with Agile in particular, and really, I mean, overall, I'll just share it. The end state is it comes down to organizational change management of any big change for any big organization, right? So a lot of people, their cheese is going to get moved. If you read that old book there about 10 years ago, it's folks, folks are resistant to change. Some will adopt it, but that's what 10%. If you've seen that curve that those smart folks who do organizational change management will share you. I'm not close enough to recall the person's name, but yeah, there's some folks who jump on it. There's some folks who are like, okay, we'll get with it. There's, and there's some folks who you've got to drag kicking and screaming, eventually. And those are the folks that lag with the thing. But then eventually, you get to the point where it works. Initially there's some level of inefficiency, right, as the change happens, but then you get over the hump and it actually works. The thing we learned there is we tried it. We tried When I was at ICE, we tried a little bit to try to do it organically, bottom up, and go to the top. And it was efficient, but you can't really scale that well because what we I, at the end of the day, let me just share that we determined at headquarters, DHS, to do it. And actually, above DHS, we at the management directorate level, the undersecretary for management at the time determined we're going to mandate this. We're going to put a line in the sand and we're going to do it. So what the undersecretary at the time determined is that go pick me five programs in the early stages of acquisition IT programs, and he authorized us via a memo to throw the rule book out. All the, the sort of the old SDLC from, the military that we'd all adopted, and which I was at the time an expert at, as much as an expert as I could have been, right? Not that expert, but I was pretty well. It's what my job was.
Right.
But I was the thing that I'll share a little aside is that we had tried some agile, we had tried just bringing in a bunch of brand new folks who were all about agile, and that didn't work either because all the grizzled veterans of the IT program managers that had done SDLC for years, they just were not getting all the new lingo, right? So we had to, I brought in another grizzled old veteran and converted him, and that's what my role was, to try to explain to these folks how to do it. But you got to have that top cover, and so having the undersecretary sort of mandate it, and that we picked a couple of actually started before that we actually had written we had made that determination to mandate Agile for IT development, not acquisition, not COTS or anything at the time, or anything else but software development. And we wrote it into policy, and that was 2014 when we finished the rough draft. And then we had to go, it goes through the approval process for policy, and sort of policies at DHS, and I suspect elsewhere, have to go through every component CIO for approval. So they all get to take a look. And if any of them say, nope, not going to do this, or they want a change made, then you negotiate that back and forth. That's even in the modern AI policies. That's why it took a year to do face recognition, for instance. So, but it's appropriate because you end up getting a better product at the end. It ended up taking 2 years to go back and forth getting the Agile policy done. So in that time, it wasn't until mid 2016 we actually got it signed. That gave us a lot of time to roll it out and to roadshow it. And I and one of my teammates at the time went out, and we just met with everybody, and we got that we got it roadshowed. So by the time that it actually did get signed into policy, and it came in with like, okay, then six it gave it I think a 6 month window for they had to show that they were agile or show that they were on their way. We needed to get an idea of where the enterprise was, program by program, component by component. So nobody's hair was on fire when that came out because we'd had 2 years to kind of to let them know it was coming. And then by the end of 2017, so that was a year and a half later, but in December 2017, all of the major IT acquisitions at DHS, that's about 100 programs that are over $300 million life cycle and above, all of them were agile, reporting as being developed using agile techniques. So that was pretty sweet that we enjoyed that. But then we continued on, and you got to keep after it because there was some backsliding a little bit in some areas. The big challenge is people move on, right? You have to continually reinforce these things because folks just move around quite a lot. But and then we started tackling DevOps as well. But that was purely the software delivery piece of it that we tackled. But then a new CTO came in, Mike Hermes, in the mid-teens, and actually they made an adjustment. And my division, which had worked for the business management directorate at the time, was moved under the CTO. And the thought was, let's get as the new technologies emerge, let's get the policy and governance right there with them, because in the past we'd sort of been playing catch up in some cases, or at least been we're a little bit siloed out. So what CTO determined is, hey, we're gonna rewrite the entirety of the acquisition life cycle from thought to the time we deploy, so that we can make sure all the processes of IT acquisition are aligned. And so this is when the undersecretary said, okay, great, give me five pilot programs, and we'll throw the rule book out. You guys can do anything you can do to get these five to be successful and to get them churning out software. And so and some of them are still around. One of them is retired because it met its need, and it's not fun, it's not making any more significant investments, it's doing its job. A couple of other ones are like leading the way. Matter of fact, three of them are really considered really great. And then there's one other one that was kind of like a North Star at the time. It was already doing well and it's still doing well. But we learned 18 different specific things that we felt like we needed to streamline. And we got those all done. Took a couple of years, but we were tracking that really strong. GAO had learned about this. GAO actually came to us and said, "Hey, you guys are doing Agile as a major organization. Other agencies we talked to were telling us they can't. So we want to sit in and sort of see what you guys are doing." And of course, we were happy to host them for 2 years on,
Sure.
and then and so they tracked those 18 action items very, very closely. And we got them knocked out. The one thing is that there's a couple things on training we had sort of a disagreement on, but of course GAO gave us 10 recommendations as well, even though they came in saying that we were doing great. But we're always willing to do better. Oversight is important. It's one thing I think, if I can, for an aside, people may not realize out there is that, you hear a lot about in the heartland about, feds just kind of kicking back. And I think the latest thing I just heard about is taking bubble baths or something,
Right.
when they're working remotely. Well, anyway, nothing that we do is not measured by the legislative branch, right? We're the executive branch. We have a bunch of laws we need to implement. They fund those laws over at the legislative branch, and by golly, they send GAO to go make sure those laws are being met. And so everything that we do is being tracked and measured, and we have to, and appropriately, right? We want to make sure that we're giving the federal taxpayer their money's worth and meeting the mission as best we can. And so that's a thing that, I don't think people generally understand that everything that is, if we're supposed to be doing something, we're being measured on it. And we're continually sending those updates to Congress, continually sending them to the executive branch. So sometimes when you hear that, folks aren't doing anything, I think a lot of times people are making statements that they know are less than not true. But I mean, that's all I'll sort of say about that. But the Agile Acquisition Working Group was set up back then, and basically, what we did is we went to, and this was the CTO at the time, credit him, Mike Hermes. He and I went to every chief executive officer at DHS management directorate at the headquarters, and we got their buy-in on this process. So we went to the procurement office and we determined with them, and they gave us, every one of the CXOs assigned at least two folks to work with us. And by the time I left in January 2024, that team was still meeting. This combined team was still meeting monthly to make sure that everybody was working together, at the same time. But the chief financial officer, the chief procurement officer, the science and technology directorate, who are our good partners in the SDLC analysis, program analysis and risk management, the pure acquisition folks, those were, again, our other, there's triple chair for IT, the CIO, PARM, and S&T Systems Engineering. S&T also manages the test and evaluation on behalf of DHS and puts out that governance. And so all of those, hardworking folks wrapped up together to make IT policy and governance. And we changed 18 significant things, the streamline, and got those five pilot programs way further than they would have been, because we really focused on them. But then, program six to infinity, we're all able to take advantage of the streamlined processes that we found by virtue of the undersecretary signing that memo. And of course, there's continual improvement is the way we do it. And so those continue on to this day. But
No,
senior leadership, top cover is super important, and consistency.
okay. So even as senior leadership changes, because I know, I mean, you and I both know that there's turnover in a lot of those top positions. Some administrations have more turnover than others. That continuous top coverage is super important, I would assume. And Continuing to get that buy-in from folks has to be, I mean, that's just it's, it sounds like a huge job to get that buy-in, and then obviously because whenever you're doing something new for the first time, there's a lot and there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen, anytime you're doing something with the federal government, which I also find really interesting. Makes sense why there should be, right? I think that I also think that one, you touched on some misconceptions, and I agree with you that people don't understand. I think that there absolutely is, there's going to be some waste and abuse, and as there is in any system, anytime you a company or a budget gets large enough, there's going to be, misspending. There's going to be the left hand and the right hand aren't sure what they're doing. Like that's just like lack of communication. I think that's just part of it. And when you start looking at the scale of the operations that the federal government undertakes, right, before you even narrow it down to one agency and see the scale of the operations that DHS takes or HHS takes on a daily or weekly basis is incredible. And we shouldn't I'm inclined to agree with you that you shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You should absolutely understand there's a lot of value in a lot of the stuff that has been going on. Does that mean we can't get better? To your point about continuous process and continual process improvement, no, it doesn't. I think we should absolutely continue to strive to be better. But yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And I think that it's really interesting to see folks and it's interesting to see very loud opinions from people that have never worked in the federal government having and are not an expert on anything that the federal government does, right? Having very strong opinions about it. It just seems interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that, but I also and I but I but I railed against, I was a mid-career transition. I didn't become, a Fed until halfway through. So I was a contractor for the first third of my and then a DHS, and I don't intend to stop working, at least not now. So maybe the final third I'll be a contractor again. But yeah, it's I there were certain things at DHS that I not just DHS but in federal government I rail against to the very last day, and I was a big change agent myself. Now that's an overused word. I'm not claiming that so much except to say that I was never happy with the status quo, and I was a little bit of a troublemaker. People have like but I was also a tester. I've been a QA tester for years and years. I don't believe anything. Trust but verify. Why do we do it this way? Why do we do it that way? Is there a better way? And for instance, federal hiring, I mean, it's just it, that killed me till the last day. They were happy when the last Fed I hired, it took me 9 months from what time one of my team members retired to the time I was able to bring in a new person. I mean, you just can't work that way. And I mean, with the young folks are not going to put up with it. You can see it now. There's way too many folks in federal IT over 60, way too few under 30. And unless they can really get that pipeline refreshed, it's going to be a problem. Of course, with the new administration, we'll have to see how that goes, because perhaps there'll be fewer folks to worry about. But the other piece was, procurement, right? I mean, and I'm on the industry side there now. But federal procurement, to me, when I was a PM, to me, I just needed to get the job done. My primary job was what I was assigned to do. And the kind of the way the federal, maybe this is everywhere, but the federal government worked is you had to switch hats, and had to become a procurement expert when you wanted to, put a new contract out. I'm like, well, hang on, isn't there somebody I can just call and give my requirements and they'll go take care of this? The answer is no. Same thing with hiring. You say, well, I really like to get this position filled, and you come up with a position description, what do you want the person to do, and some nice person in the personnel office will hand you a stack of stuff to fill out. And those are two of the areas that I think are just have just a lot of possibilities for AI coming in and help. And we'd actually started with the hiring piece. I'd had one of my teammates writing some RPA bots to help the HR folks there at DHS with their hiring. And I suspect that's, and we had a couple of wins early on. I suspect that's on, I know it's ongoing. And so they're just, to me, it's almost with both of those, you sort of have to know the inside game, and it's not so much just getting the best. It's going through the process, knowing all the ins and outs and how to play the game. And I mean, I don't think ultimately that helps the federal taxpayer, but those are big, big issues to fix. And that's just two of many. So I support any modernization. If people come in with a pure heart and really, really want to fix things, I'm looking forward to that partnership,
Absolutely. Yeah, and I agree. I think that hiring is absolutely a piece, huge piece of hiring is absolutely a huge piece of it. I think I've seen the federal government like trying to come up with more interesting and more creative ways to help bridge that gap. We're actually one of my companies is a sub on this GSA program that was trying to bring or is trying to bring stat like more industry standard staffing and recruiting practices to hiring full-time federal employees, right? On a, I forget the name of the employee type, but it was like a temporary federal employee up to 4 years, get brought in, get hired at however many, within the GS scale, of course, as everybody is. But then, I mean, we won that program 4 years ago, and it's been used. We won that. It was an IDIQ or a BPA 4 years ago, and it's been used once in 4 years, right? And so then you look at, speaking of procurement, which I absolutely agree is something that needs to be streamlined. Now this organization in GSA spent a huge amount of time putting a procurement together, right? Getting a because I mean, you know how much effort goes into doing that on the government side of getting a solicitation out and reviewing all the responses. Did all that, and then nothing was ever done with the program, which is, as somebody who has responded to bids and responded to this one and won, and then to win it and then have nothing come out on it is frustrating to say the least. But you look at, I think that though, there's a lot that goes into it. But what are from having been on the inside, what are some of the things that the government, how should the government streamline some of those hiring processes? And in an ideal world, how, like from a time, like from a preparation of a PD or position description through hire, how quickly should that take? I mean, how long should that take as opposed to 9 months?
Well, I mean, to me, a month, or tops, if you can, depending on if you're seeing everybody. I mean, there's a couple of nightmare scenarios I saw with my own eyes that troubled me a lot is that in one case, there was a person who was marked as highly qualified, superior, in fact, and the hiring folks told them that, but they submitted, like one of the forms was required to be submitted. And it's, I think, the SF-52 they're called, if I'm not mistaken, but it's where it has your time in rate and all that stuff. But they use the same form if you get a bonus. And so this person got a performance bonus for outstanding work, and they submitted that for not realizing that they use the same form for both things. So submitted the one with the bonus, and that one is not a cumulative form. It just was a separate one sent. So the one he sent did not have his time and rate on. So the HR person let him know, well, sorry, you weren't selected. You're a superior rated, top rated candidate, but you sent the wrong form. And he said, well, cool, I'll send the form over. But no, sorry, it's too late. And they made another selection. And I mean, if you can imagine that happening in the industry, how ridiculous would that be? Yeah, get me the form. We're good. You're the top rated candidate. But they did the same thing with procurement as well, right? You go through and you get down selected perhaps, and you do your orals perhaps. And in one case that I know of, the company was marked superior. The orals went great. The past performance was great. One of the people on the prime contract, however, because it takes some time to get these things awarded, was offered another job and took it. And this was one of the key personnel. And so here was the company was rated highest superior, the best rating, everything like that. But sorry, you're not compliant because one of your KPs is no longer there, the one you submitted. And I feel like, okay, that's the rules of the game, that's what you have to do. But The government's very black and white like that in some things. And I guess some, that's probably an order of protest. But what I have to imagine is in this modern era where people move around and get, especially think about cyber skills, people are jumping from, from opportunity to opportunity a lot of times. And with, rightfully, we work for our families, right? Ultimately,
Oh, yeah.
we're not coming to work to hang out. We're taking care of our families ultimately, plus and do the mission while we're there. But that's something I'd like to see done a little bit better. But I jumped to procurement for a moment. Let me jump back for a minute to the hiring thing, because another nightmare scenario I had, and this actually happened to me at DHS. We were hiring for a customer experience expert, and there were some folks that already worked there that I was really interested in having aboard. But we took a look. We put the PD out, and it went through OMB, and they did all the stuff that they needed to do. And we got back the list of appropriate of folks, and there were people on there that I absolutely would have hired in a heartbeat that didn't even make that list. And I'm like, what is going on here? And so, and actually, I, pulled my boss into it, and we actually got on the phone with OMB, and we're like, what's going on here? What is how did some of these people, which we literally would have hired in a heartbeat, not even make the list for our consideration? And there is sort of a test. There's a couple of tests you take. There's one, the general test, and then there's, for general knowledge and stuff, and then there's another one specific to the rate. Well, my question on those was, well, hang on, if you're talking about specific to like the IT rate, what's that mean? Are you asking my policy person for CX whether or not they can change patches on a server or whatever? What is it? Because IT can mean a million things. Well, they wouldn't answer. They don't give that info up in order to, they don't want anybody game in the system. And so we could not get that out of them. So bottom line, and they said, well, we have all these experts in hiring, blah, 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 tell us what. And I mean, I'm not trying to denigrate them. That's the way the process is. But I mean, it's some of those. If I was king of the world and was and put in charge of it, like a group that would look for inefficiencies, I would ask about that. Because we got like a senior executive, you got a director, myself, and trying to hire for a position. And I don't know that I got the best look at the folks, because the folks that I certainly would have hired for that position, I never got the opportunity. And the only reason I knew that is because I knew that they were putting in for it. And now, a happier story, that person that did get a great job at our new CX directorate. So they did get picked up eventually. But at the time, I was going to have customer experience as part of my governance compliance work, because it was an EO, right? It came out as an executive order. Of course, Dana Chisnell and her team do a fantastic job in the CX directorate, and I think that my friend is doing really well working for her, and it's all in it. At the end of the day, it all worked out. But that's kind of a, when there are people you absolutely know can do the job, and you don't even get a chance to look at them, I just wonder what else is being hidden in that process.
Huge amounts, huge, like the not having any transparency into the skills test that they get is a huge red flag, right? Because like, I mean, I hire a lot of people, Bill. I've been hiring people for 15 years now in the government contracting space in the DC area, right? The things that I always tell people whenever we're looking to engage with them is like the things that are going to kill your hiring are lack of communication and ambiguity, right? If you're not communicating, if you're not talking to me, telling me what's going on, why you like somebody, why you don't, what have you, we're not going to be able to refine and do a better job of finding you people. But also, if you don't know, if you can't, if they don't know where the finish line is as a candidate, they're not gonna keep hanging on and waiting, right? They're not gonna sit around and like, if you want to have 12 rounds of interviews, like some of these major consulting firms out here do, that's absolutely great. Do that. But you got to tell me so I can properly prepare people for that before I have this conversation initially, right? And then, like, I mean, like, key personnel piece is just crazy. Yeah, that's a whole other thing that we can get into in a minute. But I think it's fascinating to watch how just inefficient the hiring process is. And then it understands why, a lot of stuff should be contracted, but a lot of these opportunities, like a lot of these people in general, need to, like, the government needs to do a better job of, like, identifying people that are qualified, that and then bring them in and moving them through the process in a faster way and in a more transparent way. I think transparency is absolutely key. Because if you submit a job, and I've submitted applications on, USA Jobs, and you just never hear back from anybody ever because it goes into a black hole and I have no idea where it goes. And I always assumed that unless I had somebody like you on the other side being like, I want this guy, I wasn't going to get hired to begin with. So,
Well, there's a lot of, there's a USA job and the federal government, right? There's a lot of rules there. It's almost where, and I'm a veteran, a proud veteran, right? But it's awfully hard to get past veterans if you're hiring for feds. And I know folks who are have not been that, there's been times when as a hiring manager, I could only see two people. The answer was, yep, there's probably 19 or 20 resumes we've got, but first you have to look at the two vets. And I looked at the two vets, and they were one was a knockout, the other one was pretty good. But I couldn't even see the other folks. And so it's not, and I believe me, I'm a proud veteran. I think I have 5 points when in my hiring, right? But that's something that, it's a challenging thing, because it means, I can see getting to the head of the line for consideration, but if I can't even see anybody else,
Yeah, it's
now what are
crazy.
we really talking about? And so, and those, and you know, none of those folks know that, right? None of those folks, they're sitting around waiting. So 21 people put in for this thing. And in fact, the one veteran, for a time said, no, I'm not going to go forward. So then I could see the other 19, and there were some really solid people. And I'm like, wow, let me start setting up some interviews. And then the veteran changed their mind again. And then it was back to, nope, you got to pick those two. And then the rule was at the time, you could write, I would then have to have written a memo saying why that veteran was not qualified. Not that they weren't the top, but why they weren't qualified at all to do the job. And what my HR exec at the time told me, that she's never seen one be accepted. So we went forward and, hired the two veterans. And but again, this gets into a whole thing where, I love my vets, man. Spent a lot of time with those folks over the years. But when you think about, I mean, and again, it's not going to be popular, because I'm of an era where vets did their job, more proud to do their job. But I think sometimes people tend to worship them more than support them. If you want to support your vets, support your vets. But all the platitudes in the world, don't help sometimes. But
And
anyway,
it is 15%
but
off out
it's
back.
a microcosm of society, right?
Yeah,
There's
man.
They do a great job. They're out there on the front lines. They deserve, sure, let's put them in the front of the front of the line. But again, I think it's those binary black and white sort of decisions that the government likes to, have, that sometimes don't let you make the best choice.
Yeah, no, and there was somebody I used to, it was a acquaintance of mine 20 years ago now at this point almost, who was a is a veteran. I did IT support for, honestly, I forget who, one of these agencies, had so many of the veteran, like the points between being veteran and disabled, a couple of other things, he couldn't get fired, right? And I think that, like, on that side, and trust me, this gentleman, Bill, should not have been, he was not employable, but he was able to get in. He got his job. He'd show up to work one day a week, right? Maybe. And like the boss his boss couldn't get rid of him, because, and so I think that, like, Some of the well, like, yes, you should absolutely have protections, especially in a federal
Right.
workforce where there's turnover at the top every 4 to 8 years, and you look at new political appointees coming in. You shouldn't be able to like they shouldn't be able to just clean house and fire half an agency
Right.
overnight. But there should be some tools in place to ensure that you can not only hire people that hire the most qualified person. Because but also get rid of people when they're not performing.
Right.
Because having sat in hiring for so long, I don't care what your educational background is when I'm looking to hire you. I don't care where you're from. I care whether you meet my qualifications and you can do the job, right? And if you don't meet the qualifications, but you can really do the job, I'll have conversations. And that's when you go to the person, and obviously this is all industry side, but you go to the person like, listen, they don't have a master's degree, but they have a bachelor's and 8 years of experience. Can we do something? And because if you want the person, like there's always a way to make it happen, but that doesn't seem to be the case in the federal government.
Right. It's challenging, right? And so I've unfortunately had the opportunity to be part of some of those things. And let me tell you what, it takes you, it shouldn't be easy to fire somebody. It should not be easy. It shouldn't be a win, right? But it should not, it shouldn't be impossible, right? And
I
in
mean,
some of those,
as
it takes.
devil's advocate, Bill, I apologize for cutting you off. At running private companies, I'm pretty sure most states are at will employment, right? Where I can fire my employees for any reason, no matter what. Like, I don't think that that's all the way there, but why shouldn't the government have that ability?
Yeah, I don't know. It should be something between that. That's where I am now, without getting too much away. I guess I just did, but that's I expect that, right?
Everybody is.
Especially in the in this sort of work. But yeah, it shouldn't be easy, but it shouldn't be, the times I've been involved in it in the federal government, and it's never a happy time, and it's you have to go through quite a lot. And it was 6 months of that being co-equal to two or three other major things I did, if not more, right? That becomes your job for that amount of time as a senior, as a supervisor. And so now you're taking away a couple of people from what they should be doing otherwise. It's a heck of a challenge. But anyway, I guess I think we'll see what happens. There's obviously the next administration has some ideas about that. It's going to be interesting to see what happens when that desire hits the policies and procedures and laws and unions and things like that. Although we didn't really use a union at oversight for headquarters, but certainly the folks are there to look out for folks that in the HR space.
I would also assume your friends at DHS are going to be less on the chopping block than some of these other agencies out there when you consider the mission, right? Like, the EPA is they're always in the crosshairs anytime that there's a Republican administration coming in. But so I think obviously like AI to help with hiring and help with the screening and vetting process could help move some of that along. I know we did a whole event about that. You appreciate you coming to Collab Solutions, where we talked all about procurement and AI and new tools in the procurement process. One thing that I'm really curious about, though, Bill, is you've been through a lot of administration changes in your career of public service. What are folks that are what you know what are your friends thinking? What are folks in that work for the federal government thinking now? What is everybody? Kind of where how do these go from, I've never been through one internally, like as a Fed. What's it like when that happens?
It's always a challenge. And I was in the Navy at the time, but I go back to the Carter to Reagan transition and everyone in between, even though I haven't always been directly with the government for the vast majority of my time I have been. And it the two administrations have slightly different the two parties, I should say, have different goals to often. But ultimately is to support the federal taxpayer. But it is a challenge. In the past, I've had some of my friends who worked at places like civil rights and civil liberties. Obviously, that gets a little bit. It's not the priority, I should say, in some cases when one of the parties comes in, and their opinion at the time. And I knew some of the senior. I guess some GS-15s there. They were like, they're trying to kill this place. And so they were doing basically, following along as best they could within the law, right? That's the thing. We're still a nation of laws. So, and even in the military, you can't give me a illegal law, right? You can't make me break the law. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. There's some big changes, but really what you do is you're there to do your job. The thing that I loved about being a Fed, and I think I would have to say the vast majority of all my partners there, when we all raised our hand and took the same oath to the Constitution that our folks in Congress and the Senate and and in the White House do. So we believe it, to the nth of our core. It's not that big a document. And if you haven't read it recently, folks, everybody seems to cite it, but few people actually know what's in it. It's not long. You can read it in under an hour if that is. It's pretty small, including the articles. So take a look at it and see what it actually says. And it and we do, I would say the vast majority, certainly the folks in my experience, believe in that and wholeheartedly support it. So within that, then the party in charge and the Congress, both the executive and the legislature, they have every right to push in whatever direction they want to within their constitutional boundaries, right? So sometimes you have to suck it up and do something you're not happy with. Other times you're more happy to do your job, but I think you're always doing your job. And the thing is, really at the end of the day, you try to keep the politics out of it. You just try to do the best thing you can for your federal, taxpayers. And the interesting thing is, when any new administration comes in, or even a new exec comes into the federal government, they come in with a bunch of things they want to do, and they're really excited. And here's two or three big things we're really going to push forward. And there's people who will teach you classes on appointees versus careerists, right? So the careerists are out there to do their job the best they can to help the federal taxpayer within the context of what their jobs is. The appointees come in with two or three big ticket items that they really want to tackle. And that's when sort of the negotiation happens, right? Because those folks come in, they may not realize all the laws and policies that you're working under. They may not realize all the things you've been doing for like a decade. And in my case, for the Agile and stuff, every time somebody new came in, I had to explain, man, the great stuff you got signed up for, we're all behind it. But here's the things we've been working on for two or three or even four of your predecessors that have been signed off, and we're almost there. And of course, the money does kind of trickle in from Congress, especially for federal oversight. So we're not quite there yet. And we would, so you sort of have to brief every new exec that comes in. And this happens at all levels in the, as new appointees come in, as new senior executives, SESs come in, you have to brief them on what you're already doing and how you can meet their goals, but not ditch everything you've been working on. So that happens at my level for new SESs that come in for as a CTO and CIO. Number of things, my team did in the CIO's name, right? Federal IT dashboard, for instance, had the DHS CIO's name on it. But all those numbers, all the risk ratings, and all the numbers came from my team and from my team at the time and from our business management directorate partners. So, when the new CIO would come in every year, I'd say, "Sir, man, here's the things I'm doing on your behalf. Do you want an adjustment in how you review it? Do you want to change the way you do it?" And some folks would tell me, "No, just keep on rolling. Let me know if you have a problem." Other CIOs were more interested in that particular aspect of the job, so they would say, "No, I'd really like to see this." So you kind of go either way, but you just don't let them get blindsided. But then take that up a level. When these appointees come in with some very specific things they want to do, they're going to have to be briefed up on, well, here are the laws, and here's exactly, how we're following these laws, and here's the policies, and here's the precedent that we've been doing. And then you sort of negotiate to some extent because, you come in and you think, wow, I got X number of people at my disposal, and I'm going to do these three bullets, and we're going to knock this out. But then you realize that you don't really have that, X number of a percentage of the people are doing something else in accordance with the law. Other people are doing something else in accordance with policy or precedent. And then you maybe have a smaller percentage of folks who could just truly work on your priorities. Now, laws can change, policies can change, but then that's a matter of putting that into place and then getting that going, which adds a little bit to it as well. So that's, and I think people don't realize that. I think the people who make the statements about coming in and making big changes don't realize this. And I think that the folks out in the heartland often don't realize this either. They just don't get why you can't just go in there and change things and go in a different direction. That, federal government is truly an aircraft carrier. It is not a, it's not a speedboat. It takes some time to turn this stuff. And it probably makes sense, right? It's slower than you want, but maybe too slow. But you also don't want to be zigzagging back and give people whiplash on, I think you see that in some of the other countries around the world that are not quite as advanced as the US is.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the bureaucracy is a feature of the country, not a bug in a lot of ways, right? Like we want anytime that there's new elected representatives coming in, they're going to bring in their people. Like you want to ensure continuity of service delivery, right? Because I think one of the things that a lot of people don't understand about the government and how it differs from a business is that the fundamental goals are incredibly different, right? Businesses' goals are to return profits to their shareholders or profits to their owners and just let and go out and make money and you make a world a better place. I don't think everybody in business thinks that way. Everybody is out here trying to make, do well for themselves and do well for their families. The government's job at a fundamental basis is to return services to the taxpayers, whether those services are, schools, roads, bridges, infrastructure, secure borders, protection, military. Like there's a lot of services that get returned. And I don't think that it's like the government doesn't need to make money. It'd be great if they could balance a budget, but making money and like being, having a net profit is not the fundamental goal of the government by any stretch of the imagination, nor should it be. And so, I think that you're absolutely right. And part of the reason that I'm doing this podcast is to help people understand what goes on in the federal government, what goes on in a lot, what, provide some transparency into, AI, what AI is, but also the Fed and the federal government, what the federal government is and how it, how it actually impacts their lives. Like a lot of people don't realize that huge amounts of road repair, that's federal money. Like it's done at the state level, but those are block grants that get passed out from the Fed to the state, and the state like administers it how they should, because they're going to have better understanding of their roads than the federal government would, right? And so, I just think people don't really understand the depth and breadth of the federal government, what it does, you can talk about how you don't want to spend money all you want, but like I like having roads. I like knowing when it snows that it's going to get plowed. I don't have to think about it, right? Like that's just handled. I like knowing that I turn the lights on. There's electricity there. There's a lot that goes into it, man. It's and I just don't think there's enough transparency or respect, frankly.
Well, people, I'm an older gentleman here, so as I came up through school, I took civics, right? And I don't think they teach that around the country. I know that they don't, and it's you need to understand how this place works, or you're at risk of being, having someone coming and promise you a bunch of stuff, and which all politicians want to promise you this stuff, but they don't have the capacity to deliver on that stuff. And then when it doesn't happen, then you're like, wait a minute. But again, just like we were just talking about the internals of how the federal government works. Well, the same thing, at the legislative or an executive branch. I mean, the government has the president has a bully pulpit, but Congress has to vote on stuff. But if you don't know that, then you're I think given unrealistic of course they'll promise it whether they can deliver or not. But that's some things the president can only bully pulpit, away, and some things that Congress needs to do. And I have to tell you, I mean, I'm a little disappointed. I mean, there's some basic stuff they need to be doing, And one of them is getting the budget in place. And holy cow, as a Fed or even as a, even as a citizen over the last 10 years, I mean, it's just not getting done. I mean, if I had my magic wand, I mean, I would make a rule where everything that one of the chambers or the other put forth had to be voted on up or down within 90 days if you couldn't get the, and that would change so many things because the ability for one person to sit on things and not even bring it up when, X number of people and or even the populace wants something, I think that's really it's really hurt us. And that's I think as well a lot of the distrust in the government has been generated because just vote on it, because that's not what they want. They want to work it to where it's the most advantage or not bring it up. Don't even get me started on some of the Supreme Court cases over the last couple years. It's just but that's my sometimes I t and tend to be a little Pollyannish. And at the end of the day, the process is the way the process is. It's you got to work within it. You can't hope for something better. You can hope for something better, but you can't, it's not the way it's going to work until those changes are made. And there's a big lot of folks that are just opposed to making those changes at these major changes. And
Hope is a terrible business strategy. I've been saying it for a long time. Like you can hope for the best, but let's get in here and have a plan, have contingencies, this go out and make it happen. Yeah, I really appreciate it. But as we're getting ready to wrap up today, man, anything else you'd like to say? Any other points you'd like to make about, the transitions, DHS, AI within DHS, rolling out these systems? Anything we missed?
Well, I think the one thing that I never got done at the heck, and nor has anyone, yet, is really getting the old systems retired, right? I mean, poor Senator Marjorie Hassan out of Maine, I think she's been after us and she sends letters every year, and correctly so, wanting this done. And the investment, though, the dollars aren't there. And the question is, how do if you got a system like cutting checks for the American public, it may be on a mainframe, it's charging along. If you don't get the equal investment to build something new and transition over, then how do you do that? There's so many strategies out there, modernization in place, the strangler strangulation method where basically you build a system around the existing system until such time, and then make changes to that piece of the system until such time you can turn off the internal one. There's a whole lot of that being talked about, but actually getting it done is has been a challenge, and that's the thing that I really never got done. And I say me, but we at Homeland Security didn't get that done, and other agencies haven't either. Is like, we were able to rewrite the front end of our acquisition process. This is like 10 years ago now, so it probably takes a little more, and it's been tweaked ever since. But that back end, that O&M, right, operations and maintenance, where 80% of IT spend happens, it hasn't been solved yet. And some of the interesting things I saw is maybe I won't cite the name because I may get that wrong, but maybe what someone put forth is like, hey, maybe we're looking at this the wrong way. Maybe we shouldn't worry about that 80% of IT had spend in O&M. Maybe we should wonder about why are we setting aside a special section of IT at the beginning where we're so rigid with our rules for for acquisition, but then it goes into O&M and it doesn't get any oversight, right? And I think maybe what we need to do is just really embrace DevOps and put out MVPs, come up with a standard like idea of what a minimum viable product is, and then build to that and then build onto it. Now that's a challenge sometimes. You can't just put a user interface out there in the federal government and say, okay, wow, we did that. Because what is the way back to 2012, the OMB mandate was usable functionality in 12-month increments or less. I think it was 12 at the time. I can't remember it. And it's laughable now, right? In the modern, we I know at headquarters, my good friends in their development division churn out new releases every 2 weeks on all their products. And of course, your Netflix and Amazon and folks like that are doing thousands of mini releases a day. We'll never get there at the headquarters, but We should be able to get around our changes out at the speed of the mission, right? Whenever we see a new threat vector, let's get something out there in certain systems. But what is that whole thing has to happen. And I think AI can help us quite a lot with that. One of the really interesting things I've seen, and is we've been trying to tackle this for years, is okay, how do you break down what the COBOL code in a mainframe says? How do you re-envision that in a new system? Well, at the end of the day, sometimes in the past we've just said, well, screw it, we're just going to say, what does this thing do, and write a whole new set of requirements and try to build something new. But I think with modern AI, you could, have it take a look at what this thing is actually doing now. Go write us the code that, that can be equivalent to this. And I think we're probably going to be seeing a lot of that going in the AI. But, but ultimately turning off these old systems, refreshing them, the security is huge. And a lot of these systems can't be made secure. And especially when you think about quantum coming in, I've just been really, I mean, as smart people have been looking at it for a couple of years, but I've really been diving into that this year and the implications of it. And that's going to be huge. And, the threat actors out there are already gathering tons and tons of data and just storing it for the time when quantum becomes available. And then they can unleash that on that data. And no doubt they'll turn up tons and tons of things. So,
I did a whole episode on store now decrypt later, and how fast is a fascinating. It's fascinating. Quantum in and of itself is fascinating. I did an episode about post-quantum cryptography a couple of months ago, and super interesting stuff. But again, people don't understand. People don't understand AI. We can't even start having conversations really about quantum yet. But we need to be, because you're absolutely right. When you start looking at, the legacy systems that are out there within the federal government, right? You look at something like a, it's a super easy one, like a FPDS, right? Where you can go on and the federal public spending data, right? That system looks like it is 25, 30 years old, right? And it probably
It
is.
is.
And it was probably cutting
1990s
edge at the
era.
time. Yeah, probably late 90s. Probably was cutting edge at the time. But now, it has barely usable functionality for today's day and age, right? Just because it's new doesn't mean it's going to be better either, right? And so I think that's a balance that needs to be. But also, we need to have conversations about talent management, right? Because to your point about COBOL and IBM mainframes, and how many people do you think out there that are, let's say, under 35, have an interest in or exposure to that? And how could you even begin to continue to support these systems if you don't have anybody that can do it?
Oh, it's absolutely true, and that's the old chestnut that we always pull out, the COBOL programmer who, and that was older than me, and I've been around for quite a while. My coding skills peaked in the 80s, such as they were, but mostly around DBase 3 and Clipper, if you can remember that stuff. But we're talking DOS. DOS development is what it was. But it's an interesting thing. Talent, we could go on and on, because talent management is something I was really interested in there in the government, because I felt like, I had feds, right? And they were great and they were awesome. And they were, but we talked about this a little earlier. They were who you had. That was your team. And you could not think about it as like a sports team. You had weaknesses and at certain positions, and you had strengths in other positions. And the best thing you could do is put your ball players, if you will, in the best spots. Think about a baseball team to try to maximize success, right? But you didn't have an offseason. You didn't have a draft. You couldn't trade players. That's players, right? And it was really tough to otherwise. And so the challenge there is, I mean, so with talent, and what the government wanted to do for a long time, and maybe it's still the process, we got to build our own experts. We can't go out to industry. We got to build our own experts and get our own expertise. But really, how? Really? When one of those folks retires, and then you're gonna, and we already talked about how difficult it is to hire. I feel like talent in reskilling is a lot. Reskilling is what they talk about. And certain, we all need, look, I'm 66. I'll throw it out there. I have had to relearn IT how many times, since my old days, I was working on those UNIVACs on the ship. So you have to stay abreast. But the thing is, there's some things that I'll never get, right? I'm smart enough now, to direct some activities of smarter, newer folks who know the tech, but I'm not going to be writing any of the code. So the question is, do you really reskill? I mean, you're really going to reskill me to write like Python code? I mean, I could probably do it, but that's not the best use of my time with my skill level. So the question is, I always felt like we need to make smart consumers of the federal workforce, right? So I can do my own plumbing. I could sort of work on a car back in in the 70s. I was okay with a V8 and a few things that, but I'm not going to go work on a modern car. And I can do plumbing, but why would I when I could hire somebody who makes this, equivalent to what I make, right? And they come in and they can knock it out. They've got the tools, the technology to do it every day. Thinking about buying a house. I could sell my own house. I could buy my own house, 3 points either side. I have someone that knows the business, knows the market, knows the title company. Why would I do things or learn things to do them when I could find somebody to knock it out and knows exactly what they're doing? And I think it's a better value. So I'm not just saying that because I'm on the industry side now. I believed it when I was a Fed too, and I've spoken on it in public. I think smart consumers, so that they're not getting ripped off and they know enough to know, wait a minute, that doesn't look right. I think that's where I'd like to see it go. Now that's, that's my take on the reskilling discussion. I don't get to make those calls. I think realistically, that's probably the best way to go forward. And there's so many smart folks out there. And we're talking about reskilling ourselves. Well, the industry has to continually do that too, especially in the modern era of large language models and other,
They make
who
it
knows
easy.
what's next.
Right, but let's be clear, like LLMs make it easier. I mean, like it makes it easier to reskill and easier to learn. Like I don't know, like as far as I love your point about smart consumers, because that's my goal. And how I approach it, right? Like I'm in a lot of different areas, right? So I'm in mental health, I'm in healthcare, I'm in, IT and recruiting. I run another IT company, GovCon. I have an event comp an event that event series that I just launched with a friend of mine that you were at first time, which is great.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Appreciate that. I have a I've been doing this for 6 months, right? 7 months. I don't know, like from podcasting and events, I didn't know anything about either one. When I started my mental health company, my only experience in healthcare was as a patient. I'd never worked in a doctor's office. I didn't know what an NPI number was or what a CPT code was, right? Both are incredibly important to running a medical practice. But like, a great example is over the last 18 months, I've been working to teach myself marketing, right? Like digital marketing, internet marketing, social media, things like that. I am never going to be a social media manager, right? Or a marketing expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I need to be educated enough to have, to have conversations to understand whether or not the person I'm interviewing and having a conversation with about whether or not they I'm going to bring them on to work for me knows what they're doing, knows what they're talking about, and can actually do the job, right? I don't need to be an expert at their level, but I need to be able to meet them a little bit and then have some follow-ups and shit test them and make sure that they understand that they're not going to be able to run circles around me, and say a bunch of fancy words that and drop a couple of acronyms and then be like, oh yeah, you're smoke and mirrors. You definitely know because, like that, it. The reason I take that approach is because I write, being an entrepreneur, whether I pay person A or person B, I'm paying them, right? And so what's the value I'm getting out of person A versus person B? How do you measure that? To your point about measurement, right? I think that it's crazy to try to grow your own experts within the federal government in every area, right? Like that's just not a, that's not sustainable. And then I also think that you end up having too much, like the intrinsic value of that expert becomes too high, right? I was talking to a friend of mine over at one of the CDAOs, And they were telling me a story about how they've been having a lot of difficulty hiring and retaining high level data folks and high level a like data and AI engineers, AI like AI experts, data experts, because they can't compete with industry. This specific person, from a compensation perspective, right? This person was telling me a story about somebody that had gotten hired at the CDAO earlier this year, late last year, I don't remember which. They were all like, it took them, to your point, months and months and months and months to hire them, right? And this person gets in, gets started, got a huge signing bonus from the federal government to try to make up some of that compensation. One of the big top 20 tech companies came along and offered them like a $650,000 base and offered to repay the signing bonus as part of them coming on, right? And like, yeah, just cut the check, keep it moving, right? You're gonna 3x my take home. It's three, yeah, it's 3x, right? Like, if you want to talk about like a $20,000, $50,000 delta, you might be able to make up for that with patriotism, but you can't do that when you're literally talking at like 200 versus $600,000 base compensation. Plus, at Amazon, you get stock options, right? Like, yeah, it's before you start calculating that. So,
You just reset my my example for that because I'd seen, I'd seen double, but that's but sure, that's amazing. And the one thing I'd hoped, getting my Pollyanna hat on, which if you don't know what that means, it was like this little girl who saw is a Disney movie. She saw the good in everything. It's an old story, but and it's taken to mean people who don't really have a firm grasp on reality sometimes today. And I have to I'd be careful because with my age I use a lot of acronyms and alignments from the old days. But
I got
I'd
most of
love to see like an ROTC kind of program when you
them.
think about the military where come in and because student loans suck right these days, but come in and if you'll do 5 years for the federal government at the rates that we pay, well, we will pay off your student loans for that amount of time. And so I mean I think because I think they've got to do something to entice young people to get in here and do this work. And I mean it's something where and you can get your feet wet. And I love the four and that's I think you mentioned earlier like a 4 year optional. Oh, man, look at young people. That's a 4 years these days. That's quite a long time at a company. And I think it's different. And it's just people really need to, I think, break the glass and figure out how we're going to change this thing because it's the current stuff isn't working.
I
And
completely agree.
I don't, but it's good to me, it's a different, it's interesting, it's a different pot of money, but it's good for industry in a way because this work must get done. And I think, our friends coming in the new administration I've heard Vivek Ramaswamy say, well, we're gonna cut the federal workforce and then we're also gonna cut the federal contracts. Well, hang on, but this work must be done. So either, some combination of both doing it. And I think when they come in and see day to day what's actually getting done, and as you and I were talking, things will, there's lots of inefficiencies. Things can be cut, things can be made better. But you can't kind of cut from both sides at the same time.
But
I
you
think
also
we'll just kind of see what happens when they come in and take a look.
I agree. You also need a level of expertise and understanding of the system. And I think you need to have, like, I think to actually truly attack some of the inefficiencies, you need to have a more expertise on how it is on a day-to-day basis in a lot of these agencies, right? Somebody like yourself would probably do a have a more measured and less impactful from a like impactful so like a serve like end delivery of services to a lot of these things than somebody that is like a bull in a china shop, truthfully, let's be clear, right? And I think that I'm 100% on the same page as you. Like, let's have conversations about how we can, and let's take a serious look at decreasing spending, right? But I think that from numbers that I read, or what I like, the total spend of the federal government, do you know what percentage of that goes to the federal workforce? Do
Yeah, I
you?
personally don't, but I can tell you 2 trillion is all
Four
right.
percent.
Four,
4%. Based on my numbers, 4% of the federal spend on an annual basis, it goes to federal employees, federal benefits, right? Again, I'm here for let's have the conversations, but if you're going to start looking at a bucket and the one you pick is 4% of total federal spend, like,
Right.
What are we even at? What is the conversation we're even having then? Right?
Right.
You're not even going to pick something that's 10% to look at, right?
Right.
10%, because 10% of what, $6 trillion is, $600 billion, right? Yeah. Like that's a number we can start looking at. But when you start looking at, what, 4% of 6 trillion, what, 150 billion a year, that seems high, but maybe. No, I'm not doing math right. It's okay. Listen, I'm a
I
talker. I'm
get
not
it.
a mathematician, Bill. I apologize.
Right. Well, I think that transparency is important. And unfortunately, I think, a lot of people, and I, the electorate as well, I think we're making decisions based on, and these numbers are so big, it's so hard to get our heads around. Everybody wants to convert it to like their household budget. And it makes a lot of sense in that case. But the numbers are so big, it's hard to understand them. And what we're actually getting for everything. And I, again, well, I totally agree there's efficiencies, but where are we really going to make some impact here? And not just grab some headlines. It's going to be interesting to follow along with. I'm here for it, right? I think one thing I've read recently, I didn't think about this, but someone said, go ask the feds. Look at the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey every year. They have tons of things that they're talking about, right? And we senior leaders in the federal government every year get together. We take them very seriously. And okay, how are we going to do this? How are we going to do that? And we fight and scrap for those couple of percentage point improvements every time we measure it. But the feds will tell you, ask the feds what they think. And I think there you'll find willing partners out there for some of this stuff, even though we're dealing with 4% of it.
Right.
But
Absolutely.
that would be instead of coming in, again, I don't know how they're going to do it. I haven't seen any kind of implementation plan. I've just seen TV interviews. So, I think if they come at it with a pure heart, they're going to come in and see, wow, this is different than we thought it was. And so let's adjust and make the best choice we can. We'll see how that goes.
It's going to be fascinating, Bill. But I appreciate you coming on Robots and Red Tape today.
Well, thanks so much,
This has
Nick.
been a
It's been a
lot of fun.
pleasure.
Absolutely appreciate it. And everybody, thank you all for listening again. Hope y'all are having a great day.